So, as I'm sure you've deduced by now, I'm filling in for Professor Rice while he's away. And we're going to just finish up a little bit on the subject of barriers and then move on to deadlock. And if time permits, we'll go into condition variables, although I'll be surprised if we get that far. So the last time on Tuesday, I think Professor Rice covered race conditions. And a race condition, just as a reminder, is when you can get different results for the same computation just as a function of the timing of when different threads run, whether those threads are running on different cores or just being context switched on the same core. And so this can cause you to lose an update because you are reading a value while the update itself has not yet been computed by the producer thread. And the way that you address these is with some kind of synchronization. And the typical way to do this is with locks or barriers. A further complication is that compilers, when you don't provide any directives to restrict reordering, compilers and also the actual execution of behavior of the memory system can cause the operations in your program to get reordered in a way that behaves differently than what you expected as a programmer. And there are ways that you can restrict that reordering with intrinsics in the program that you write, or with operations called fences, but the more typical way is just to use locks and barriers. And so I think on Tuesday you covered how to use locks to cause threads to take turns in the way that you intend, and started talking about barriers. So just as a refresher, a barrier like the ones you see here will cause every thread that calls barrier wait to wait at the barrier until the specified number of threads has called that operation, and then the barrier falls and all of the threads that were waiting on the barrier can proceed. So you can think of this sort of magic central location that keeps track of how many different calls have been made to the barrier wait operation. So if you have, let's say, in a typical way that you would use barriers, if you have, let's say, a thread running on 10 cores, and you want all of those threads to complete their work before any of them can move on to some new stage of processing, then you would set your barrier to 10 in this example. And after all 10 threads have completed their work and called barrier wait, then the barrier falls and all 10 of those threads can move on. Now, I said this count of how many threads called barrier wait is, this count is like stored in a magic location. It's actually just a variable in memory. And so the barrier wait call is actually just a library call that wraps an update to a counter inside a lock operation to make sure that the counter operations are serialized and there's no data race in updating that barrier counter. And so what each call to barrier wait does is actually say, so it increments that counter, and then it says, has the counter exceeded the threshold? If so, I can go ahead and I can also initiate the wake up of all the other threads that are waiting. If my update doesn't make the counter go past the threshold, then I wait. And I assume Professor Rice is either not having you worry about the implementation, or we'll talk about it later, but that's the basic idea of how it works. And you'll be using this paradigm, I think, in an upcoming assignment where you divide work across multiple threads, and the threads each do a piece of some larger computation, and then they have to call barrier wait so that they can exchange data with the other threads. And you only want to do that after everybody's completed one phase of work. And that's a classic barrier synchronous or bulk synchronous style of computing that's used in many kinds of applications It's especially common in many scientific applications, but also if you're dividing up work for, let's say, a machine learning model where the computations are being divided across cores, et cetera. So just to test your understanding of barrier weight, here's an example that's not quite like the model I described. It's meant to be sort of tricky. And I'd like you all to think about what gets printed by that printf statement. So maybe, just study the code or feel free to chat with a neighbor. Give it a couple minutes, see what you can come up with, and then we'll discuss. So, does anybody need another minute to discuss? Okay, so we'll go in increments of 10. How many people think that the printf for the x is going to say 10? 20? 30? Okay, got to vote for 30. How about 40? How about 50? All right, yes, it is 50. Now for y, how many people think it's 10? 20? 30? 40? 50? All right, so it is indeed 50 and 30. Ooh, sorry. So clearly a lot of you we're able to sort through the sequence of operations, but let's just go through it briefly. So before anybody calls a barrier, so let me first explain that thread one and thread two are running simultaneously, but you don't know what the interleaving is, and that's why you have the barriers. So you can be sure that before either of them calls the barrier, that thread one is going to set y equal to 10, thread two is going to set x equal to 20, and they won't do anything else because the very next operation is the barrier weight. And I forgot to really call attention to the fact here at the bottom that the barrier is initialized to 2. So it takes 2 calls to the barrier weight for the barrier to fall. Now, you might wonder what could happen if the thread one calls this barrier weight and immediately runs ahead to this barrier weight, and we get 2 barrier weight calls that way. Well, that can't happen by the definition of what a barrier weight does. So thread one is going to wait here until another thread calls barrier weight. So the whole idea of a barrier weight is you stop there until somebody else calls barrier weight. And so the first set of barrier weight calls is this pair. So whichever one ends up being the second one to call barrier weight will cause the barrier to fall. That's the terminology we use. And now both threads can move ahead. Now, thread two is just going to immediately call another barrier wait. And it's going to wait for whatever thread one does. Thread one, after that first barrier falls, is going to do this computation before the second barrier wait calls. And it doesn't matter what order these happen in, because the way this is written, you can guarantee that that y equals x plus y will happen before any other work can get done. So if thread one runs, it does that addition and waits at the barrier, and then eventually thread two does the second barrier wait call. If it happens in the other order, the outcome is the same. So at this point, y is equal to 30, right? Now, after that second barrier wait call by both threads, that barrier falls, and thread one does another barrier wait immediately, so it's just waiting around. It can't do the printf until thread two does its work. And what thread two is going to do, of course, is x is going to be equal to 20 plus 30. The 30 having been written into y by thread one, x hasn't been changed since the beginning of thread two. And so that's how we get y equals 50. And remember, x and y here are global variables. And even if these threads are running on different cores, and each core has a private cache, there's a hardware feature called cache coherence that makes sure that all the threads on all the cores see exactly the same values for every variable. So there's a hardware mechanism that ensures that these changes to a variable that might be in one core's cache will get made visible immediately, or it at least appears to be immediate to all the other cores. And so this thread two, even if it's on a different core, will see that update to y that happened in thread one and get the 30 value. Now, if we don't have these barriers here, we could get all kinds of crazy values because these operations could happen in any order. And so it's the barriers that are providing the synchronization that we need. Now, we don't want the printf to happen until that update to x down there in thread two. So that's why we have the third barrier wait here. And it's only after the third barrier wait that we can do this. And that ensures that thread one sees the value of x that was computed to be 50. Any questions? Yeah.
Sorry, what would setting a barrier look like?
So there's a barrier init call. And, it's a pthread API call, where you would specify what the threshold is. And I didn't show that here. But you would actually, this would be inserted. This would actually have to happen here before you launch these threads. What's actually happening is not quite that, right? These, you would have some main that would do barrier init. This is pseudocode. Then thread one and thread two. All right, any other questions on barriers, or we're gonna move on to deadlock? Yeah. Cache coherence just ensures that when a thread on one core is modifying memory locations, that those updates are seen by all the other cores in effect immediately. That way, you never have the scenario that one core thinks X is 20, and another core thinks that X is 50. All right, moving on to deadlock. So I'm using Professor Rice's slides, as I'm sure you deduced. I actually just noticed as I was scrolling here that apparently he drew this for the UK. The cars are on the left side of the road. But so you've got two cars approaching a one-lane bridge. There are actually a few of these one-lane roads around Albemarle County. And if they cannot see each other and start to enter the one-lane section, what can happen, of course, is that neither of them can proceed, right? There's not room for them to go around each other. And so they get stalled. Now, what would you do if you were driving one of these cars? Presumably, you would try to back up and let one car go. But what if both of the drivers are really stubborn? You back up. No, you back up. You back up. No, you back up. Or what if cars have come in behind you and there's no room to back up? So this is kind of like the computer science concept of a deadlock. So let's look at a computer science example or a programming example. So let's say we want to move a file from one directory to another directory, and you've already seen locks, so we have some thread code here, and imagine that we have multiple copies of this thread code. So thread one is trying to move A to B. Sorry, it's trying to move the file foo from directory A to directory B. And thread two is trying to move a different file, bar, from directory B to directory A. Now, a simple way to implement this is to lock the directories. The directories are just data structures, right, on disk. And you can implement them as a map. And you have already seen what can happen if you have data races. You could get corruption of your directory, and then you would lose files. So a simple way to prevent that is to lock the directory or directories that you're going to be modifying. So naively, you might write code for moving a file that says lock the from directory, lock the to directory. Now I can be sure that the two directories that I'm changing are not going to be corrupted by any other thread. Now I can do the updates to those two directories, so I can put the new entry in the recipient, the to directory. I can remove that file from the old directory, and then I can unlock both directories. Sounds like a good idea, right? You could write essentially the same code for transferring money from one bank account to another, right? Let's say I want to transfer $100 from my checking account to my savings account. Well, what happens, like in the example at the bottom, if I'm moving $100 from my checking account to my savings account, and my wife is moving $100 from the savings account to the checking account? It's exactly the same scenario. So in many cases, the timeline will work out so that there's no problem. Thread one will do its work, it's finished. Thread two does its work, it's finished. Great. If these different changes happen at essentially exactly the same time, and the interleaving of operations works out the way we see on this slide, it's still okay. So thread one locks both directories. Then thread two comes along and tries to lock one of the directory, and it has to stall and wait until thread one is done. And thread one can do the move, and then it can unlock the two directories, and somewhere after the unlocks happen, the second thread will be able to acquire those locks and do its own stuff. So these are probably the more common ways that the timing will work out, but we could get unlucky. Thread one locks directory A, which is really just acquiring a lock that we've called lock A that's associated with directory A. And before it can do the second lock, thread 2 is running at the same time and locks B. Now, this could happen if they're running on different cores, and so they're really running at exactly the same time. Or another scenario is that you could have an interrupt here so that thread A gets stalled, and then thread B, whether it's on the same core or a different core, is running and is able to acquire lock B. Now, let me go back to this code here and explain why this problem happens. Each of these threads starts by acquiring the lock for the source directory and then acquiring the lock for the destination directory. And when we have this sequence here, then thread 1 is trying to go from A to B, so it locks A first. Thread 2 is trying to go from B to A, so it locks B first. But to proceed, thread 1 now needs to lock B. Thread 2 now needs to lock A. But thread 1 can't lock B because thread 2 already has that lock. And so thread 1 can't continue. Thread 2 can't lock A because thread 1 has that lock. And so thread 2 can't continue. And so just like those two cars on the one-way, on the one-lane bridge, they're stuck. And this is what we call a deadlock. So just to clarify this, thread 1 is stalled because it's waiting for the lock on directory B. And thread 2 is stuck waiting for the lock for directory A. And unless we have some other mechanisms, these two threads will stall forever. That's what we call deadlock. There is also something called live lock, which we'll talk about later, that also leads to stalls. But here, the two threads have actually just stopped running. They're waiting for locks. They're not doing any more work. They're just stuck. And part of the problem is that they're each waiting on the other. The other part of the problem is that they're holding a resource that the other one needs, and they don't let go, just like the stubborn drivers. So we can draw this graphically and see the cycle. And this is, way of drawing things is sometimes a useful tool. So thread 1 is waiting for the lock on B while it's holding the lock on A. And then the lock on directory B is held by thread 2 while it's waiting on the lock for directory A. I know I just drew the same arrows that are there, but you see here the circular nature of the dependencies. It's not limited to pairs. You can have arbitrarily long deadlock sequences. So suppose that we have a chain of three moves. So this would require move A, B, move B, C, and move C, A. Right? So what you've got here is this sequence where thread 1 is waiting on a lock that thread 2 holds. Thread 2 is waiting on a lock that thread 3 holds, and thread 3 is waiting on a lock that thread 1 holds. And you could extend this example arbitrarily. So any questions so far? So then let's look at how this looks in the timeline. There are the move files that I just described. This is another way of drawing the dependencies. So thread 1 has locked A here and is waiting on B, and it's stalled because thread 2 has locked B here and is waiting on C, and thread 3 has locked C and is waiting on A. Here's another example of a deadlock. Thread one is going to make two separate calls to allocate space or wait. Now, this is a little contrived. If you call malloc and it doesn't have the space available, it just fails. And that's actually a way to resolve deadlocks. But in this contrived example, we make an allocation request and we stall waiting for the resource to be available if it's not available now. Now suppose we only have 2 megabytes of memory. And I'm sure you can see the problem here. Thread one could allocate 1 megabyte here. Thread two could allocate the 2nd megabyte here. And then all the memory's allocated. So when we try to allocate the 3rd megabyte here, it's not available. And similarly, the 4th is not available. So this shows the unlucky timeline. Of course, the lucky timeline would be that thread one succeeds in both of its allocations and goes ahead, does its stuff, frees the memory. And as long as thread one reaches this point, then this will run to completion. Because even if we get stalled where I drew the arrow, and now thread two comes along and tries to do an allocation and has to wait, eventually thread one will complete its work because it's gotten the resources that it needs. It's not going to stall indefinitely. So eventually it will free those 2 megabytes and thread two will wake up and get its allocation and do its work. But the unlucky sequence, of course, looks like this. I won't belabor the point, but I'll pause here in case anybody has questions. So let's look at one more example. I forgot this. So here's another way of drawing the relationship here. And you can see the cycle here, although if we drew it the way that we drew the previous dependency diagrams, we could draw the 1st megabyte up here, the 2nd megabyte down here, thread one, thread two, and let's say that thread one runs first, so the allocation of the 1st megabyte is held by thread one, and thread one is waiting for the 2nd megabyte. In the meantime, thread two holds the allocation for the 2nd megabyte and is waiting on that 1st megabyte that the first thread is holding. There are different ways you can draw these dependency diagrams, but the point is that you want to be able to see a cycle. These cycles of waiting on resources are what are one of the key criteria for a deadlock. So let's see. I guess you're going to have a lab next week, actually, where you apply these ideas to a classic computer science toy problem called Dining Philosophers, which I'll outline here. So this, I think, was posed in one of the early papers that examined deadlock many decades ago. Even before I was a student. But it's a classic illustration of how you can have both deadlock and live lock. So we have n philosophers. For some reason, it's always done as 5. But it could be 3 or 7 or whatever. And they're, think of them as threads that are in one of two states. They're either thinking or they're trying to eat and eating. So they're thinking or eating, and obviously there's a transition between those two. And we have this very bizarre rule that every philosopher must pick up the left chopstick before the right chopstick. Why chopsticks? because we need two resources to have an interesting deadlock problem. Chopsticks, you obviously mostly use them in pairs, not always true with forks or spoons, etc. So chopsticks. So if we write the simple code for a thread called eat, that we're now going to execute five copies of this thread, so we want to write just one function that looks the same that we can launch five copies of. Our code might look like grab chopstick on the left, grab chopstick on the right, and then you can go call your eat subroutine, and then you put your chopsticks down. How would we actually compute what our left chopstick is and what our right chopstick is? Well, we'd be pulling locks from an array where left is maybe our thread ID number and right is our thread ID number plus one. And hopefully I'm not giving away the solution to Professor Rice's assignment, but if I did, you can thank me later. So you finish eating, then you put your chopsticks down. So anybody want to guess what the problem is? Exactly. If everybody picks up their left chopstick before anybody picks up their right chopstick, then we have a deadlock, because this chopstick is being held by that philosopher, and this chopstick is being held by them, and so on. So now when we go to pick up our right chopstick, it's already held by somebody else. So this could happen if each of these threads is running on a different core. They're all launched at the same time, and they all do the acquire of the left chopstick at the same time, and everybody succeeds before any of those threads can move on to the code to pick up the right chopstick. So sorry, I kind of jumped ahead of Professor Rice's slides here. So all of these examples illustrate the criteria that a deadlock requires circular waiting for resources, whether those resources are locks or memory or chopsticks or whatever. And it's very timing dependent. So you can have code that is vulnerable to deadlock that works most of the time, but you get unlucky some of the time. However, for as a software engineer, you need to make sure that your code works all of the time. You can't afford even a very rare deadlock, because once a deadlock happens, the whole process crashes. And the most common example that you're the most likely to deal with is when you're trying to acquire multiple locks, and you have these scenarios where two different threads are trying to acquire the same resources in opposite orders. And if we want to formalize this, the four criteria for deadlock, I'm sure this is going to appear on a quiz, are mutual exclusion. So only one actor, one thread, can hold a specific resource at a time. So only one thread can hold a particular lock. Only one dining philosopher can hold a particular chopstick, and so on and so forth. And you hold that resource and you wait until the next resource you need is available. You don't let go of the resource that you've already acquired. So like the dining philosopher picks up the left chopstick and just sits there waiting for the person next to them to put their chopstick down. But of course they're not going to do that, because the person to their right is also holding the thing that they need, and you have this circularity. So we need mutual exclusion, we need hold and wait, we need circular wait, and we need the property that one thread can't force another thread to give up their resource. So if One philosopher turns to their neighbor and says, "I'm sorry, I'm really hungry. Would you mind letting me have your chopstick?" And that person is polite and says, "Sure, go ahead." Then we have preemption. And you can formalize the circular weight this way. You can also draw it the way we've done. So any questions about these criteria? Yeah. So what you're describing is a form of preemption where the actor recognizes that there is a deadlock, or maybe just recognizes that they've been waiting for a certain timeout period and says, "There might be a deadlock. I'm going to give up my resources and try again." And that is definitely one of the ways that you can solve deadlock. Good observation. Any other questions? Yeah.
So you said that each thread waits until they don't let go until they can hold on to something else. In the example you gave, would that just be when they realize they want a different resource, or is the point that it's a paradox that will never happen?
It's like any of these examples. Let me go back to this example here. So every thread is running their own local thread logic. So thread one here is going to acquire the lock to the source directory and then acquire the lock to the destination directory. And what mutex lock does is once it acquires a lock, you hold it until you explicitly release the lock, which doesn't happen until unlock down at the bottom. And then you go and try to get the second lock. And the definition of mutex lock is, if you can't get the lock, you wait, which is how we get into all these bad scenarios, where you're holding the first lock and you're waiting for the second lock. And you have no awareness of what any other thread is doing. So these are the criteria for deadlock. And all of the deadlock solutions try to address one of these criteria. So before we talk about solving deadlock, let's just look at another example. So we have a thread body here called remove node. So we want to remove a node from a linked list. And it's a doubly linked list, so we need to deal with our predecessor and our successor. So the simple way to write this would be to lock our own node, then, because we're going to have to update some pointers in our own node, the one that we're removing. And then we're going to lock the predecessor and the successor. And the reason we have to lock our own node, even though we're just removing it from the list, is because we need to know what our predecessor and successor are, and we don't want those getting changed in the middle of the remove node operation by some other call to remove node that could mess with the pointers that we're reading out of our own argument. So to remove a node, we're going to lock the node that we're actually calling this with, then we're going to lock the previous and next nodes, and then we're going to do the standard linked list operation where we connect the previous node to the next node and the next node to the previous node because it's a doubly linked list, and then we've completed the actual linked list operations and we can release our locks. And so I now want you to think about which of these three options, A, B, or C, will actually lead to deadlock. Have the potential to lead to deadlock, because you might get lucky, but you might get unlucky. And so your actual choices here are A through G, but you know, D, E, F, and G are just combinations of the three main ones. So chat with your neighbor and see if you can decide which one of these or which ones of these can lead to deadlock. By the way, I just want to clarify that when we say A and C here, we're talking about these, right? Just in case there's any ambiguity. So in the interest of time, I'm going to cut off the discussion and move on to actually discussing the answers. So how many people think that the only answer is option A? Nothing else will cause deadlock. Right. How many people think it's B? How many people think it's C? How many people think it's D? Some tentative hands. How many people think it's E? Okay. How many think it's F? Some more hands. Anybody think it's none of the above? So the actual answer is D. So option B here will not lead to deadlock. So let's talk about why. Well, first, let's look at the simple example, which was option A. So we're trying to remove B and remove C. So remove B is going to lock B, and then it's going to try to lock A, and we don't have anybody else touching A in this example, so that works fine. And then we're going to go and try to lock C. Now, if it happens that in the middle of this sequence of operations, another thread is removing C and locks C, we have a dependency here, right? Now, the C thread, the remove node C thread, now needs to lock the predecessor, which is B. But B is locked over here. So we have this dependency. So another slightly more informal way of recognizing potential deadlock is when you draw something like this and the arrows cross. If you can line things up, this is why it's not a real reliable technique. But in this case, the crossing of these arrows is an indicator that you have deadlock. Because you've got B holding something and waiting on C, and you've got C holding something and waiting on B. And we could take this and draw it the way that I was showing previously with the actual full cycle and the solid lines and the dotted lines, and it would look just like that move file example or one of the other examples we drew. And I think everybody recognized that this is a deadlock. Okay, so now if we extend this to, I'll get to the B and D case in a minute. Suppose we want to remove B, remove C, and remove D, and all these three threads are running at the same time. Well, we have a potential deadlock here, as we just saw above, right? And we also have a potential deadlock here. This is just exactly the same scenario with the variables replaced. Instead of B and C, it's C and D, right? So what we really have here is two separate pairwise deadlocks. So it's different than that three-way chain deadlock that I showed earlier in class, where we had A, B, B, C, and C, A wrapping around. We don't have that wrap around, but we don't need it because we get the circular weight between each pair. Okay, so what about just the B and D case? Why is option B not a deadlock and option D ends up therefore being the right answer? So I'm gonna start a new example here. We've got remove B and remove D. And this is gonna lock B, lock A, and lock C. This needs to lock D, lock C, and lock E. So the overlap here is with C. However, there's only a couple possible interleavings here. If B, if this thread here manages to acquire the lock to C, it will have acquired the last lock that it needs. And now it can just move straight into doing the work, and it's not waiting for anything. And so then it can release its resources, and thread D will be able to go ahead. So no matter when this thread here stalls, whether no matter when this thread runs is what I meant to say, it won't stall forever. Because when it eventually tries to acquire, whoops, sorry, I selected the wrong thing here. When it tries to acquire lock C, either it succeeds and then moves on and acquires lock E, because there's nobody trying to touch E, and it finishes its work, and then the other thread can finish, or the other way around, thread B gets all the way to the acquisition of lock C and succeeds before D tries to grab it, and then B finishes. So we don't have the cross-linked dependency. There's nothing that B is holding that D wants while D is holding something else that B wants. So how many people are satisfied that you understand why this will not lead to deadlock? How many people want me to explain it another time? Okay, so this is being recorded. I'll post the recording. Feel free to go back over it, but I get the feeling that people are satisfied with this. So let's spend the last 10 minutes or so talking about deadlock prevention. So let me first say that with the criteria of mutual exclusion on resources that I mentioned earlier, let's go back to that list. For locks, there's only one instance of a particular lock, like A, B, and C in our examples. And only one thread can hold the lock at a time. In the case of the memory allocation, you can think of every unit of allocation as being a separate resource, like the first megabyte and the second megabyte in the example that we looked at earlier. Just think of them as being different resources. Each of them can only be held by a single thread. So mutual exclusion. So one way that we can solve deadlock is to provide enough resources that there's never a need to wait. If we have infinite memory, then that memory allocation example will not lead to deadlock. This is usually hard to do because the real world and the software world typically have finite resources. And in the most common case that we're dealing with, which is locks, there's only one lock. Only one person can hold a given lock at a time. So another way that we can try to solve deadlock, in theory, would be to have no shared resources. But then we can't really have any interesting multi-threaded programs. So that's not really a helpful way to address things. The third is what somebody suggested earlier in class, which is some version of no waiting. And no waiting could be various things. If you try to get a resource and you can't get it, then you give up all the resources you currently have and try again. Then you're not holding and waiting. You could have a timeout where you yourself recognize that you've been waiting too long and give up, or the operating system realizes that a thread has been waiting too long and either terminates the thread or forces it to give up resources, etc. There's actually some research back in, I think, the 80s on having the operating system keep track of every object that was locked and go through and analyze whether there were any cycles in the system that indicated a deadlock. So for all the resources that can be allocated and held, the operating system would go through and try to determine whether there's a cycle. This is obviously not very scalable, so that work never really went anywhere. So preemption or giving up your resources are sort of one possible way, and the other is to acquire resources in a consistent order. So let's take the first of these, and let me go back to the dining philosopher's problem. Apologies for all the scrolling. Suppose that whenever you pick up your left chopstick and you cannot acquire the right chopstick, you put the left chopstick down and try again. So this has some potential to solve the problem, right? If I pick up my left chopstick, I can't get my right chopstick, I put my left chopstick down. Now, if my neighbor has picked up the left chopstick and goes to pick up the right chopstick and I just put mine down, it can grab that right chopstick and proceed on to do its work or eat the rice or whatever. So this is a potential solution, but it also has a potential problem. Anybody want to guess what that problem is? Everybody picks up the left chopstick, everybody puts down the left chopstick. Everybody picks up the left chopstick, everybody puts down the left chopstick. And we all just keep doing the same thing over and over, and that's what we call live lock, or starvation. In the case of dining philosophers, it's literally starvation. So we can improve upon this by adding some randomized wait, where we pick a random number and wait that long before we try again. So everybody picks up their left chopstick, everybody puts it down. Now everybody picks a random number and waits that long before they try again. The odds are exceedingly high that everybody will have a different random number, and now we will break that sort of synchronous up, down, up, down, up, down. So this is a perfectly valid solution where if you detect that you're stalled waiting for something, you put something down, you pick some probably very small random delay and try again. And then If you wanted to refine this, you could imagine that you might make your random number range larger each time. So if you pick a random number and the problem happens again, maybe everybody's picking from too small a range and you end up with a higher likelihood of being unlucky. So double the number, the range. Now you're less likely to end up overlapping with your neighbors and so on. So we won't spend actually got sort of out of sync with Professor Rice's slides. If I can just jump back in time to talking about infinite resources and hold and wait, there are versions of mutex acquire or lock mutex lock that will, instead of holding and waiting, they will acquire the lock if it's available, and they will fail if the lock is not available. So mutex try lock will return true if you acquire the lock, and now you know you can go ahead into the critical section, or it'll return false, and so you have to have a loop here that basically keeps doing mutex try lock until it returns true. We talked about the no waiting. An important note here is that this requires some way to undo any partial changes. So like, let's say with the move file or the moving money between accounts, if you did any work between the two lock acquisitions, if you now want to abort your function when you get stalled on the second lock, you obviously need to undo any state changes that happened in between. The final thing I want to talk about is acquiring the resources in consistent order. So let's go back to this move file example. The problem, you'll remember, is that we had thread one was doing move AB, and thread, forgive my pseudocode here, was trying to do BA. So you have one thread trying to acquire the locks in the order AB and another thread trying to acquire the locks in the order BA. And that's what leads to this circular dependency. Well, what if we change that function to always do the locks in order? So we do a lexicographic a lexicographic ordering of the source directory and the destination directory, then what this will lead to is that we lock A and lock B for thread one, because A comes before B, and thread two also locks A and locks B, because A and B, again, you know, alphabetical ordering. Now there's no deadlock, because they'll each try to acquire A first. And if thread one succeeds in acquiring A first, then thread B stalls on A. Now thread one can go ahead and grab B and do its work and release its locks, and thread two will be able to proceed. So a potential ordering looks like this. We lock A, lock B, move A to B. Thread two, we stall on lock A, then we acquire A, lock B, and move B to A. If we were doing this with account numbers, like my example of I'm moving $100 from checking to savings, and somebody else in my family is moving $100 from savings to checking, we can just do a numerical sort of the account numbers and always acquire the locks to the account numbers in numerical order. And Any kind of consistent ordering that all the threads agree on will suffice. So any ordering will do. So we can compare pointers, or we can do a lexicographic sort, which just means alphabetical, or numerical sort. And I think we're about out of time. So sometimes APIs that you're going to use in the code that you're writing, so you're calling some libraries, the documentation for that library will specify that you should acquire the locks in a certain order. Or the comments in the code may specify the ordering. Any convention will suffice as long as everybody follows the same convention. And I think that brings me to the end of the deadlock section. So this is the last slide from Professor Rice's slides. So we saw the four conditions for deadlock. You should definitely know those four conditions. And then each of those conditions suggests a way that you can break the deadlock or avoid the deadlock. So let me just make one final point before we leave. There's a difference between deadlock avoidance and breaking deadlock. So deadlock avoidance is you prevent the conditioning from ever happening. And so this is a way of avoiding a deadlock. This is a way of avoiding a deadlock. And this is a way of avoiding a deadlock. The no waiting, depending on how you do it, can be avoiding a deadlock or breaking a deadlock, right? So if you set up the no waiting condition so that you never create a deadlock in the first place, that's a deadlock avoidance. I can't give you a good example of that. But if you detect that there's a potential deadlock and then give up your resources, like, for example, you use the timeout approach that we talked about, that's breaking a deadlock. Or if the operating system goes through all of the dependencies and detects a cycle and then kills a thread or forces it to release processes, that's breaking a deadlock. So that's a distinction that's of minor importance. The most important thing is that you remember the four conditions for deadlock. You'd be able to reason about examples like we did today, and you'd be able to give examples of how you would deal with each of those separate deadlock conditions to resolve an existing or a potential deadlock. So I think on Tuesday, Professor Rice will do a brief review of deadlock, and then you'll move on to monitors and condition variables, and I think you'll have a programming assignment involving dining philosophers. All right, thanks everyone, and especially thanks for coming all the way over here and waiting for me to sort of catch up.